Now, I think companies lose at the end of the day because their productivity isn't good. They're always going for the bottom line rather than the best product, the best quality, and the best workforce.
Well, I was going to ask you that, David Black, because, you know, you look at this and you say, how can this possibly be good for a stable business environment? And I wish the chamber would take some of the resources that they're using to deny workers the right to join and form unions to go after some of these insane trade policies, to go after some of these beggar my neighbor policies.
Yeah, well, that's not a bad suggestion. Right now, what I see, you know, on the national level, we do see an increase in, you know, you talked about the free choice item issue, and you know, there's some other labor issues that are on the top priority in Congress right now, and I'm one that believes we have to get closer to the middle. We have to labor can't push entirely for a labor agenda, and business can't push entirely for a business agenda. We've got to get in the mindset of being more competitive as a country, and labor and management have to work together.
And that's where we will find absolute agreement, because what I'm seeing is that the pendulum has swung way too far to your side, Dave. Honestly, business has way too much control over the workforce. Point in fact, I mean, this company just up is and it's going to abandon this town. That building is going to be left. Who knows what's going to happen with that? You've abandoned 340 workers here. They're going to go down and hire 440 workers, probably at the same price down in Tennessee. There's something wrong with that.
They're just shuffling folks, and they've offered people from here to get down there. I don't know how many ultimately get down. And Carlisle's going to have this building. Carlisle and Tire Wheel may own it or may manage to sell it. Who knows? But it's not going to be the manufacturing plant that it was. And I know that part of what they were looking for here was another better place to make their products, and I think there were other buildings, current buildings available for them, but the company just made the decision, nope, we're gonna pack up, we're gonna go to Tennessee.
Well, let me ask you this: do you know much about because I'm getting bits and pieces of exactly what they got. Councilman Tim Scott said $18 million a total package the company got from the state of Tennessee. I'm curious if you know any more on it.
I know bits of, like Tim, I guess I know bits and pieces. One of the things that they had that we don't have, power is supplied down there by the Tennessee Valley Authority. It was a big public works hydro project that was done in the 60s, and they're the electric utility. And so as an authority, they have a lot more flexibility than PPL has here as a regulated utility. So they offered him an incentive package. It's some kind of a startup incentive package that they're actually their electric rates are greatly decreased through the first few years. They offered him a local real estate tax abatement program that went 20 years. In Pennsylvania, it's only legal to do a local real estate tax abatement for a maximum of 10 years. But this was a 20-year program at the local level. And then the state offered up something similar in the lines of what we call an opportunity grant in Pennsylvania. Those dollar amounts, I think, were pretty similar. I've heard that it was about $750,000 each, and that's flexible money that can be used for almost anything, as long as it's legal, of course. And then I think there were some additional job creation tax credits, and I don't know what the total package is, but it's my understanding that it was substantially better than Pennsylvania's.
Wow, and I look at that and I go, where is that money coming from, one? And two, when you start handing out this kind of money, who ends up covering the difference? And for me, it always ends up on the backs of those who can least afford it, the working people, the homeowners, the poor. And that's what, I got to tell you, that's what frustrates me to no end, that we're heaping rewards on these companies while society suffers. It's frustrating.
Well, and it's going to be the taxpayers of Tennessee that are footing the bill for that, because the Pennsylvania package, all the Pennsylvania economic development money, it has to be state money. We can't use federal money to attract a company from another state. So it's the state of Tennessee and the locals have put up this tax abatement money, and that's where the money's coming from.
Yeah, but you look at for every dollar. I was just looking at some numbers here a little bit ago. For every dollar that the states pay to the federal government, the southern states get their entire dollar back plus some in federal money. States like Massachusetts get 69 cents for every dollar they send to the federal government. And you see states like Tennessee who get substantially more than they pay in. So by saying that they're not using federal money is not really accurate. They're using federal money for other things. They're just using the money, the state money that they would have used to do this with. It's just shuffling around funds, and it's something that should stop. Do you know of any legislation or any movement to bring this to a stop?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your last question.
Do you know of any legislation on the federal level? Because I've been looking like crazy to find somebody who's willing to stand up in Congress and say, you know what, we've got to stop this.
I'm not aware of anything. And actually, the point you made is a good point. While the federal money's not going for economic development, it's probably freeing up some state dollars that otherwise would go for economic development. I'm not aware of anything federal level, but I think it's probably something that we could talk to a bipartisan team like Todd Platts and Tim Holden that kind of represent our district here, and maybe the two of them would start to think about something like that.
I'm right there with you. We should start that. I'm right there with you.
Okay. Let's give it a run.
I appreciate you taking time for us, David Black. President and CEO of the Harrisburg Region Chamber and Capital Region Economic Development Corporation. Always great to talk to you.
Thanks, Rick. You have a good afternoon.
You do as well. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back.
Again, that's 877-960-0960. Now, here is Rick Smith.
The more I look at this situation, and I really want your opinion on this, because I think this is important, especially as a nation where we're supposed to be one nation. This beggaring each other, stealing from each other, this is not productive. And what it is it shows a failure of leadership at the national level. It shows a failure of policy, and it really highlights the glaring failure of our trade policies. Not only are we fighting with every other country around the world to retain jobs, we're now fighting with each other. And what's and why I know this is a failure. You know, I grew up as a kid in Cleveland, and I saw this failure firsthand. And was it a total failure? Of course not. No, the big multinational corporations, they save billions. Their bonuses and their stock options, they did pretty well. And yes, they did create some jobs, although not as many as one might think, since most of the workers moved to the area to follow their jobs anyway. So what you had is when Senator Voinovich was mayor of Cleveland, he decided that, you know, we're losing our industrial base. We're losing our steel plants. We're losing our machine shops. All this stuff is now, thanks to the Reagan policies, leaving the country, moving down south first, but then leaving the country. So he said, you know, I got to bring some businesses in here. We got to do something. So they went out and they attracted these Fortune 500 companies. In fact, Cleveland has, I believe, the fourth highest number of Fortune 500 companies within its borders. So they brought all these companies in, and they gave them the world. They gave them 25-year tax abatements. They gave them free power from the city-owned power company that Dennis Kucinich refused to privatize. They gave them, you know, the world with the sun around it. They gave them land. They gave them building loans, guaranteed loans. You name it, they gave it up with the thought that we're going to bring jobs into the area. It's going to create an income tax base for us to fund the things that we need. but you gave all the property tax away. You gave away all the corporate tax away. You gave all that away. And those workers, when they came to the city of Cleveland, they moved to the suburbs. And with them, they took all of their income taxes. So you have very nice, very well-groomed, upper-middle-class suburbs, and you have a city that is crumbling. And I go home to Cleveland every once in a while, and you go to the east side, and you just, and even the near west side, you just marvel at the fact that we don't call that terrorism. And I'm saying that this is a form of economic terrorism. There are 340 families in this community right now who in 15 months, their life is upside down. Their lifestyle is done. Because statistically speaking, and we've seen report after report, that once people lose jobs like the ones that those 340 people have right now, they never get back to that wage. In fact, over half of them end up working for almost half of what they were working for before. So we're seeing a decline in the standard of living of the American worker. Why? Because we're allowing these companies to jump around like marauders, sucking the lifeblood out of our society and shifting that onto the backs of you and me. And again, you know, what's going to happen when this place closes in 15 months? As Tim Scott said, we're going to lose a significant tax base. We're going to lose some money for the schools. We're going to lose some money for services. What's that mean? That means larger class sizes. That means less money for schools. That means less money for social services. That means less services. Or it means we're going to raise taxes. And nobody wants to raise taxes. You look at what's going on at the state level right now. You know, we're fighting over funding group homes. We're fighting over funding services for seniors. We're fighting over all of this stuff because we don't want to raise taxes. And what's frustrating, again, you know, we were willing to come up with, from what I understand, almost $7 million to give this company just to stay. You know, whatever happened to the days of, and you look at this company, and I read one article of the guy who, as a kid, it was his job to puncture the tires. What happened to the day when the company was part of the community? And this guy talked about it. He said, look, you know, they were integral parts of this community. The CEO was part of the community. Now what we have is this greed-based, hooray for me, and the heck with you system. This cutthroat, beggar my neighbor system. And, you know, I got to tell you, it reminds me of growing up in the projects. Where I grew up as a kid, you know, pretty much in American poverty. What you had is you had people robbing each other. And they were robbing each other for food. I remember on days my mother would go grocery shopping and we would leave the house. And we'd come back to find the window open and stuff out, and the majority of the stuff out of the cupboard gone. Why? Because your neighbor stole from it. It's basically what's happening here. Your neighbors are stealing from you. And we have a federal government that is sufficiently weak and unable to stop it. You know, you look at the last 8 years, the destruction of the regulatory oversight system. And you go, yeah, here's where it is. This is what's wrong here. And it's frustrating. Because, you know, all those 340 people who work at that plant, they gave their lives to that company. They work very hard for that company. They make that company profitable. And what did they do? What did the company do? They said, well, we got a better deal somewhere else. But if you want to come to Tennessee, you can fill out an application and we might hire you. And I'll bet my bottom dollar that you're going to make, 20 to 40% less than you were making here with less benefits. Is that the way to go? Is that the kind of society we want to have? Because that's the way we've been going the last 30 years. That's the neoliberal trade policies that we've had in this country for the last 30 years. Who's willing to work for less? Not do we have a quality product. Not do we make the best product on the market. No, it's all about who's willing to do it cheapest. And as I you know said with David Black and his quote, you know, do we want a nation of disposable, exploitable workers? Is that what we want? Do we want cheap, exploitable labor? Do we want to end up like Mexico or China or Indonesia or Pakistan or any of these places? Do we want to end up working in conditions like that? Because I'll tell you, open up your closet, look on your bookshelf, find all the products that are made everywhere but right here. And then look at the working conditions of those countries. Is that how you want to work? Are those the working conditions you want for your children? I'll tell you flat out, I don't. And I'll tell you what the workers in this plant should do. And I'll tell you what I would do if I worked at Carlisle Tire and Wheel. I would be one of the people organizing a sit-down. I would be one of the people saying, you know what? Shut it down now. If you're going to go, go. Go now. By staying, all you're doing is helping them in their transition. You look at other places around the country that have done it. Republic Doors and Windows. Workers said, you know what? We're not going to take it. We're not going to take it anymore. And is that what it's going to come back to? Is that where we're heading? Now, I sure hope not. And this is where leadership on the federal level has to happen. And this is where I think, you know, President Obama has to step in and there has to be some legislation. And I got to tell you, I'm going to call David Black later in the week and try and push something like this. Because we have got to stop this. You look in Ohio, for instance. Mr. Tan Man, Boehner. It was his district that lost 800 jobs to Georgia. And in the press release from National Cash Register, they said they got federal stimulus money. They've since changed that. Say, oh, well, we just got all state money. But to say that, you know, but they didn't get any federal money is ridiculous. Because they used that federal money to free up state money. It's just a matter of calling it something other than what it is. And what it is, folks, is it's them stealing from you. It's them taking tax dollars out of your community and giving it to someone else, i.e. the corporation. I mean, the citizens of Tennessee aren't even going to benefit from this other than getting a couple hundred jobs. And if you remember the whole NAFTA discussion, what was supposed to happen to Mexico? We were supposed to raise up their standard of living. Have you seen the maquiladoras on the northern border of Mexico? Have you seen the conditions that these people live in? They're living in tarp tents, drinking out of barrels with poison sticker labels on them. Is that a raise in their standard of living? Of course not. Because we know that once NAFTA happened, our agribusiness flooded their market, destroyed their entire farming community. Destroyed their entire farming industry. In fact, the Mexican government had to change their constitution to steal land from communities to be farmed just to sign NAFTA. I'm telling you, folks, at some point we've got to wake up. And all I heard in this whole debate, oh, just that the workers wanted too much. You know, the workers in Carlisle wanted too much money. That had nothing to do with it. You know what it was? It was $18 million. It was free electricity. It was all that stuff, all those goodies in that bag that the state of Tennessee put together. Just like the state of Tennessee put together $1 billion in subsidies for the Volkswagen plant. $500,000 per job. $500,000 per job. You give me $500,000, and I'll create one job. I'll tell you that right now. I'll be happy to create a job. I'll have the guy go out with scissors and cut my grass all day long. And I'll even pay him $50,000 a year to do it. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. It's a system that is just plain nuts. And we just seem to go along. Yep, well, it's a good idea. Because business should get what business wants, right? Isn't that what we're told? Business gives us jobs. They give us our job. Well, they don't give you anything. You make them money. If you didn't make them money, they'd set you to the curb. Or they'd find someone to give them state subsidies so they could move out of the state. We're going to take a quick break. We're back with Dr. Steven Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. We're right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Which side? Are you on the side of the multinational corporation? Are you on the side of the big corporate interest? Or are you on the side of the workers? And, you know, to kind of go back, I still can't find anything that says Carlisle Tire and Wheel is a union facility. In fact, some of the people that I've gotten emails from say they is not. So the whole union issue here with Carlisle Tire and Wheel is a false one. And again, you know, that's an easy target. It's an easy target to say, you know, wow, it's those wealthy union workers. From what I'm told, these workers make about 30 to 35 grand a year. These are not the highest of the high-paid manufacturing employees. And those jobs are too high for this kind of a company. And what we're seeing, again, is this, you know, I can't say it enough, this beggar my neighbor, steal from my neighbor to enrich myself, and in the long run, end up harming myself. Because I got to tell you, I think these subsidies are also harming the taxpayers of the state of Tennessee. But here to talk a little bit more about that is Dr. Steven Herzenberg. He's executive director of the Keystone Research Center. KeystoneResearch.org is the website. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Rick. Good to be with you.
You know, I look at this situation and I go, you know, I don't see how taxpayers in Tennessee are going to benefit much from stealing jobs from taxpayers here in Pennsylvania. Your thoughts?
I mean, you're right that at least overall, it's a beggar thy neighbor policy. It's what some people call a zero-sum game. In other words, if there is any gain to Tennessee, it's offset by the loss to Pennsylvania. Sometimes the only people who gain are the shareholders of the and the managers of the company, because sometimes they make these location decisions. It's got nothing to do with the subsidy, but then they just take the handout. You know, bottom line is, this is not the right way to be creating jobs, playing states off against one another. You know, you're right on the money.
You know, I look at this from a policy position. And for me, the policy failure here is that the federal government has allowed states to engage in what I call a negative competitive scenario. This is a race to the bottom. This is down the drain economics, in my opinion. Why aren't we seeing the federal government doing anything to stop this?
It's job piracy is what it is. And there's discussion about doing something in Washington. There was also discussion about doing something during the Clinton administration. And it's not really all that complicated. You could do something like, for example, the federal government gives all kinds of different program money to states, something called the Community Development Block Grant, for example. You could say, if any time a state takes jobs from another state, you know, then there'll be an exactly offsetting reduction in their block grant equal to how much the size of the subsidy, right?
Right.
So, I mean, there is discussion about doing that. You know, so far that hasn't gathered any momentum. Obviously, right now there are a lot of bigger picture issues, health care, the Employee Free Choice Act that folks are preoccupied with. But this is one of these kind of below radar things that if we don't fix it in the first few years of the Obama administration, you kind of want to throw your hands up. So I think it's great that you're raising this issue. I'd be wondering about why can't we get a progressive senator like Bernie Sanders or someone like that from Vermont, or Bob Casey, to sort of pass something that says, anytime something like this happens, then the governor or local official in the area that's getting the job has to be part of a public meeting and a press conference in the place that's losing a plant.
There you go.
Something like that.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is you bring up Senator Sanders, and I've heard him speak of taking highway dollars, federal highway dollars, away from states who engage in this. And there's a start, but the larger question here is, why do we subsidize these companies at all? I mean, shouldn't we be competing on a plane of saying, you know, we have the best educated workforce, we have the best infrastructure, we have the best, you know, transportation lines, you name it, we have this to offer, not just here's a heap load of taxpayer money.
Oh, you're exactly right. Now, again, this kind of approach to creating jobs or stealing jobs goes back a long way. I mean, it goes back, some people say, to Mississippi in 1938, so the South did a lot of this as it was taking manufacturing jobs from the North. In Pennsylvania, this kind of approach really started back in 1956 when we had parts of the state, coal regions in the state like Schuylkill County and the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area, that were just hemorrhaging jobs. And so there was an incentive program put in place that still exists today, and it was sort of to give that area, you know, some additional leverage in a desperate situation. But so, again, you might say in certain situations, if it's tightly controlled, like if an area has a very high unemployment rate, right, or, you know, or if you've got the good jobs or you've got strong protections against, you know, no company gets it if they violated any laws about workers' rights to form a union, right? So there are maybe a set of criteria you could put in place, but basically your bottom line is the right one, which is this is not the right approach. The right approach in terms of the government helping create jobs is an approach that maybe benefits one state in particular, but benefits everybody, or at least doesn't hurt everybody. So when we do, for example, the stimulus, the Recovery Act that we know from yesterday may not be big enough, but is sort of, it's helping, right? Suddenly, the economy in the second quarter of this year did a lot better than in the first quarter, and there's one simple reason. It's the Recovery Act. It's the government picking up from the private sector, getting the engine of economic growth going again, and so that we can stop this nosedive. That's a sensible way. Or if you want to look at energy, right? So the state of Pennsylvania, for example, has a variety of policies that are meant to stimulate the creation of a renewable energy industry and to create energy efficiency companies. Some of that, maybe more than I wish, is handouts to companies. But at least in that case, it tends to be companies that aren't relocating, right? It's the companies that are creating a plant somewhere for the first time.
And that's the important point here, and I wanted to get to that. Because the important word there is creates new jobs, not just shuffles jobs from area to area. And where I would say tax dollars could be used is to create something new, not just stealing from someone else.
Right, right. No, it makes perfect sense. And so, you know, as a policy analyst, and you used that term before, I mean, it really doesn't make any sense. But it's one of these issues that's sort of complicated enough or technocratic enough that at least so far there hasn't been enough of a hue and cry. And another part of it is, I mean, when an area or a country or a state are desperate for jobs, people want something to be done. And governors want to be able to do something. And local officials want to be able to do something. So part of the challenge is we haven't been good enough at coming up with a more modern approach. Again, European countries, Asia, they put a lot more money into developing new industries, into technology transfer, what to me make a lot more sense in terms of approaches. We do some of that, but we're still sort of hooked on this drug of competing state against state, municipality against municipality for a limited pot of jobs. You know, it is the wrong approach. Again, hopefully if we raise enough hue and cry about examples like this one, we can fix it.
You're here listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Dr. Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center. KeystoneResearch.org is the website. You know, one of the things I hear all the time, Steve, is that, you know, Pennsylvania loses jobs because of all the stinking unions and because it's the third highest tax state in the country. Unionization in this country is about 7% in the private sector.
Right.
Pennsylvania's taxes, from what I understand, on corporations, The majority of corporations in this state pay no taxes. To me, it seems like a fallacious argument.
Yeah, no, no, absolutely, it is. And actually, even studies by companies, consulting firms that do tax work for corporations, like Ernst & Young, the accounting firm, they show that Pennsylvania's corporate tax base, when you look at all the taxes that corporations pay, including things like property taxes, they're kind of right in the middle. You know, if you want to, you can get 21st place to 33rd place, depending on exactly how you look at it. No, but so the bottom line now is that the way that jobs move has more to do with transportation infrastructure, workforce, quality of life for executives and managers, what's your technology support system, whether it's information technology or whether it's the availability of scientific workers and engineers and universities nearby. So that's the right way. And again, Pennsylvania actually does more of its job creation is in those sensible directions now than 25 years ago, but too much of it is still in the old approach. And actually, partly because of the budget situation at the state level, I suspect this is happening across the country, but it's certainly happening in Pennsylvania. You actually are getting the legislators in Harrisburg and the Rendell administration are looking at some of those subsidy programs, and those are going to be shrinking, I think, for sure, in this budget. So we may have a unique window to try to reduce these kinds of approaches and focus more on the ones that do make sense. Again, in the end, you're right that the fix here is in Washington. If you create a set of rules, you eliminate really the benefit for a state to steal jobs from somebody else, then the behavior goes away.
Yeah, well, I just heard about a million Tenth Amendment nuts and teabaggers fall over by you saying that. Because part of this whole teabag movement, this whole Tenth Amendment movement that we're seeing, is economic. It's businesses funding this stuff, saying we know that when the federal government is weakest, we can pit states against each other. And I'll tell you, that's where the funding is coming from for some of these crazy groups.
Right.
Let me, for a second, I want to go back to the state of Tennessee for a second. This Volkswagen plant, $1 billion, $1 billion in state subsidies to bring 2,000 jobs, about 500 grand a job, to the state. One of the things that I saw, the state of Tennessee was hailed as winning the deal of the year. This was a great deal. My question is, Volkswagen was going to build a plant somewhere.
Right.
Is there any guarantee that $1 billion, if not spent, the Volkswagen would have ended up in Tennessee anyway?
Absolutely, it might have. Now, again, the way this stuff is done now is, without the kind of discipline from the federal government, these plants aren't sited without a big subsidy. And that's because the process now, the subsidy might have nothing to do with it. But the game now is, let's say you make your location decision or you winnow down to two places or three places, and then you go shopping. The consultants come in, or the big companies may do this on their own, but a lot of times they'll still get what are called site location consultants. And they basically know how to do the smoke and mirrors game with state governments and, basically threaten to take it somewhere else and so all you need is one state out of a bunch that might on paper be competing to break ranks, and in practice every state virtually the line you get from officials in Pennsylvania and I'm sure elsewhere is we can't unilaterally disarm. I think we keep going back to we need the federal fix. The other piece of it, it is a bit more complicated when you look at the history of these deals. I think the basic finding is that this money is not a good return on investment. So there have been more big handouts to Dell or to, Mercedes or to, General Motors earlier in Tennessee for the Saturn facility that didn't lead to a new industry cluster, that didn't lead to a lot of supplier plants, where the initial investment of subsidy dollars by a state was never paid back, right? So, but then there are one or two cases where, you know, a state gets lucky and they get a they get a big facility at a time where they are developing their own industrial base in a sector like auto. No, so sometimes, so those, the examples where, after the fact, state officials can tell this, tell a story to themselves about, well, South Carolina got itself a new industry through a big subsidy to an auto company. Those kinds of stories muddy the picture in terms of figuring out what really happened, and also muddy the politics and the policy in terms of, you know, pushing governors away from playing this kind of game. But the bottom line as a policy analyst is not far from where you were implying, which is that this is not a good return on investment, even for the state that's bidding for the jobs, that's stealing the jobs.
Well, let me ask you this last question before I have to wrap this up. You know, I was talking with David Blackie earlier in the day from the Harrisburg Chamber of Commerce, and right. It was his suggestion that we gather a bunch of people together and try and get Congressman Platt and Congressman Holden to do something on a bipartisan level. Any chance in working through something like that?
So he was suggesting to get the feds to jump in and say that Tennessee can't do this or to stop this kind of thing?
Well, he's looking for a federal law saying, no, you got to stop this stuff.
Yeah, good for David. Good for David. I think that's a great idea. You know, I mean, again, nothing ventured, nothing gained, right? So I'll give David a call this week. And, you know, I there is, again, a debate in Washington. I'm out of touch in terms of exactly where it is, you know, about how to stop this war between the states. But it's never going to pass if this is an opportunity, a political opportunity, right? This kind of sensible rule to check this behavior, to stop this behavior, is only going to happen if the places that are pissed off, like Carlisle right now, when they're pissed off, say, hey, let's get the rules we need. So, I'll do what I can to encourage David, and at the very least, you know, I think we can get more attention to this silliness, and let's see where it goes.
I absolutely agree. Dr. Steven Herzenberg, I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much, Rick. Take care.
We're going to take a quick break right here. We're right back with your calls. 1-877-960-0960. We're right back.
The dirty little secret, Marianne, is that every Republican in this country wants Obama to fail, but none of them have the guts to say so.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You know, this issue, I've gotten a lot of email over this. It's just plain wrong, and I think most people agree that it's just plain wrong. Let's take a quick phone call before we move on. Elizabeth, how are we doing today?
I'm fine, thank you, Rick. I was listening to your program, and I concur with almost everything you have to say there. I grew up in Carlisle. Matter of fact, I grew up on College Street, where the plant is located. I played with the founder's granddaughter, was one of my best friends for a long, very long time. And I've seen that street change dramatically. But when I see what's going to happen with that closing of the plant, I'm thinking, I don't know how they're ever going to do much of anything there in Carlisle. They have lost practically all their industrial base there in Carlisle. It's a very expensive community to live in. And I don't know what the workers are going to do. There's not that many jobs around. So, and as far as I'm concerned, loyalty went out the window so long ago. And if you read the article that was in the Sentinel where they interviewed Lincoln Worrell.
And it did.
So that's what I knew My father had worked there for a very long time, retired from there, and it was a wonderful company then. But now, once we get big, this is what happens. And when we go from one state to the other, and as you say, you know, one state's trying to outdo another, and I don't know how they think they're going to get jobs to stay around, but I don't envy the people living in Carlisle any longer, because it's going to be hard. And as far as building anything there, they have an awful lot of low-income property in that particular area now. There's an awful lot of that, so I don't know if they need much more of that there.
Well, I think that's a step in the right direction. Build affordable housing. I mean, we've been seeing these McMansions going up all around the area, and a lot of them I've been seeing now are empty. Not all of us can afford $300,000-$500,000 homes. I say you build homes in a more reasonable price range, you know, $75,000 to $100,000, and you allow working people to have the ability to own a home. And really what we've learned from home ownership is that is one of the ways that people build wealth. And I think it's a good start. If you're going to lose something like that factory, I'm in favor of tearing it down and making it a residential area.
Well, it was once a residential area, so they'll just have to restore it, really.
Yeah, I appreciate the call, Elizabeth. Thank you so much
for
your story. And, you know, again, it comes back to this, what's happened to our country when corporations, you know, like Elizabeth just said, she played with the founders' children. That's what's gone wrong with our country. We've allowed the CEO class, we've allowed the wealthy class to attain so much wealth and to become so wealthy that they can live in gated communities, that they can live on private islands, fly in private jets. They're no longer connected to us. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, you saw CEOs making 40 times what the average worker is making. Now you're seeing anywhere between 300 and 500 times what the average worker is making. There's a disconnect. They no longer see the impact of their decisions. And, you know, it doesn't matter. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about business. And when I've been reading these blogs and these comments on the news articles, the amount of disinformation and the insanity on these posts just worries me, because you got people saying, look, well, you know, the company should be able to go do whatever they want because, you know what, they're just in it to make a profit. Well, if that's the case, if their companies are just in it to make a profit, they should all move to China, where you could get really cheap, exploitable, disposable labor. And then they could just dump everything back here in the U.S. as they've been doing for years. You know, I can make any company profitable. Move them to China. Move them to India. Cheap, exploitable labor, no environmental regulations, no labor laws, no pesky unions, no pesky regulators, no pesky lawsuits from poor products. You know, who was held accountable when all those animals died from the melamine in the pet food? Who's been held accountable for all of the lead poisoning and the toys that came from China? Nobody. You can't go. You're going to go over to China and sue them? Good luck. Let me know how that works out for you. I want to go back to this economic development thing real quick. I want to wrap this up before I move along. West Virginia has been doing this kind of economic development, giving out a whole bunch of money to bring jobs in. And interestingly enough, a couple of studies that have been done, they've shown that the jobs that they've brought in, only 1 in 5 jobs met their criteria of a median wage of $14 an hour. Only 1 in 5 paid above poverty wages. And to me, that's just amazing. So if you think the way that we're funding job growth for low-paying jobs and, you know, high-profit jobs is a good thing, then we should continue what we're doing. I mean, West Virginia is a perfect example. They've encouraged the growth of all these service industry jobs. I'll wash your clothes, you come wash my floor. Or, you know, I'll cut your grass and you wax my car. That's not how you build wealth, folks. You build wealth by producing things. I can only walk your dog and you can only cut my grass and build so much wealth. It doesn't work that way. And this, you know, again, and my wife is sick of me saying it already, but this is the legacy of the Reagan years. This is the vision of Ronald Reagan. We are living his legacy. And if you go back and you read his speeches when he ran for president in 1980, he said it flat out. I want to make this country a service-based economy. And you look around. What are we? We're going to take a break. We're right back. 1-877-960-0960.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this safety bill of rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or were likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on-the-job injuries have fallen 40% and on-the-job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches, an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
And welcome back. 1-877-960-0960. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Like many states, Arizona is desperate for cash. Arizona state lawmakers are considering selling the House and Senate buildings, then leasing them back for the next several years before assuming ownership again. Also, they're looking at leasing this whole lease back thing and selling off of a dozen other state buildings as the state works through these huge budget deficits. Other candidate properties range from state prisons and mental hospitals to run-of-the-mill state office buildings and the Karchner Cavern State Park, the crown jewel of the state park system. And what we have here, folks, is we have state governments who are so strangled by this starve-the-beast mentality that the conservative Republicans have been pursuing for the last, and a lot of conservative Democrats have been pursuing for the better part of the last 30 years. Starve local government, starve the federal government, so that we can't afford Medicare, we can't afford Medicaid, we can't afford the programs and the services that our citizens want. Starve the beast. As Grover Norquist said, I want it so small I can drag it in the bathtub and drown our government. Well, this is what happens at the end of the road. And we've been selling off state prisons for years. I mean, most of the state prisons around this country are privatized for-profit prisons, which is why we have the prison industrial complex we have today. But, you know, selling off your state parks, you know, I don't know. Anyway, under a complex financial arrangement, state government services would continue without interruption while the state picks up cash, about an estimated $735 million Here's the interesting part. You look at Arizona. They have about a $10.7 billion budget. They have a $3.4 billion shortfall. $735 million is not going to help with that. And, you know, I hear it all the time. Rick, you just hate rich people. That's all. You just hate rich people. Which is kind of ludicrous. Because I still hope one day that I'm going to be rich. But what's interesting is how easily we've been so easily misled into believing there just isn't enough money for anything. There's no money for health care reform. We hear this all the time. The Republicans and the conservative Democrats, they're out there saying, oh, we'd love to help you, but we just can't afford it. And I say nonsense. You want a revenue stream? I'll give you a revenue stream. New York State's Attorney General's office released a study this week on executive compensation. And surprise, surprise, what'd they find? They found that executives paid themselves more in bonuses. Bonuses. They paid more in bonuses to themselves than the company earned in profit. They're ripping us off is what's going on. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo said on Thursday that, quote, there's no clear rhyme or reason to how banks compensate or reward their employees. His investigation suggests a disconnect between compensation and bank performance that resulted in a heads I win, tail you lose bonus system. Listen to a couple of these numbers. According to the report, Goldman Sachs earned $2.3 billion last year. They got $10 billion in TARP money. They paid out bonuses of $4.8 billion, more than double their net income. Morgan Stanley earned $1.7 billion last year. They received $10 billion in our tax dollars in bailout money. They handed out almost $4.5 billion in bonuses, nearly three times their net income. J.P. Morgan Chase, same basic scenario, earned $5.6 billion, took $25 billion of our government money, paid out almost $9 billion in bonuses, and it goes on. You want a tax stream? You start taxing these rich people. You start taxing these CEOs who are making millions and millions of dollars a year. You tax Dollar Bill McGuire, who made $1.7 billion in 2007 from the healthcare industry. That's where you get the money from. Let's take a quick call. We got Helen online, too. How are you doing today, Helen?
Hi. I was just listening to a show about pirates and them attacking these cruise liners and rich people. We're not talking about the Caribbean. We're talking about around the world in Southeast Asia and going through these places around Somalia.
Mexico, too.
Yeah. Well, these people got attacked by pirates, and they expected the U.S. military and the planes to come overhead. And these were, you know, I mean, you could tell these were very rich people, you know, just by the way they were walking around and the size of the ship. It wasn't your regular, you know, three-day cruise kind of thing. And they actually, you know, they thought, we were waiting for the cavalry to come. And, you know, it's the very kind of people who don't want to pay the taxes to pay our military to have the ships cruising in these foreign lands. And somehow or other, I don't know what's wrong with them. And the same thing with the shipping lines. They're wondering why the government isn't doing more to protect them when they're shipping, and they're not willing to pay for it. So, I mean, this is another aspect. Not just this local loss of money when they don't pay taxes.
Well, the interesting part of that, if you go back to the time of the Constitution, there was only one military branch that was supposed to be around during peacetime, and that was the Navy, to do just that, to protect the commerce lines. That was the only reason we wanted. They said we should have a standing Navy. In fact, the Founding Fathers distrusted a standing army. And here again, it is our responsibility to protect our commerce lines, but these corporations have to pay the bill. And I didn't see the story of the yacht being taken over. That's something I'm going to have to look for. But I have seen places where tour boats have been hijacked and people have been hijacked and had their money stolen from them in Mexico. Anyway, Helen, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Anyway, you know, the thing is what you're seeing. And that's a funny story. They actually thought that, you know, the U.S. Navy is going to come swooping into their defense. That's, wow. Well, I mean, it's that sense of entitlement. We're special. We're wealthy. We have these big yachts. We're captains of industry. We're special. That's good. I love that. I don't know if you saw this. Rupert Murdoch's rag, the New York Post, reported this week that our government is going to be spending millions of dollars of stimulus money on a quote-unquote deli run. They're going to be buying pork and ham for the nation's emergency food banks. The Murdoch rag reports says that we're going to spend $17 million on canned pork, $1.2 million on 380,000 hams, and $2.5 million on frozen ham. So we're stocking our food pantries. I think that's probably a good investment. Good investment. But here's the thing. Good investment under a misinformation campaign by grade school math flunkies like the people over at Drudge Report have this this story going this way. Evidently, they're claiming that we're spending $1 million on just 2 pounds of ham. And they've got the whole right-wing blogosphere all up in arms, all crazy. We're gonna look at that. That's waste. That's fraud and abuse. Turns out we bought 760,000 pounds of ham, not two. So what they got? You got a very weak, backhanded apology from them. What do you expect? Anyway, also convenience store operator Quick Trip Corporation is going to be paying current and former employees in nine states nearly $750,000. And back wages after an investigation by the Labor Department found that they weren't paying their workers overtime. They, you know, like Walmart did, you know, clock them off. You can keep working, but we're gonna change the clock. Kind of funny. Anyway, I want to get to one email before I take a break here. I got this one from someone who obviously didn't sign it. Rick, I didn't hear you discuss the situation leading up to Beergate. Given your background, I'm surprised you didn't discuss the issue, especially since we have a racist president who always sides against white people because he hates us. Do I even need to comment on that? The stupidity of that. Let me start with the incident. I didn't talk about this because I think it's a nothing issue, and I thought I did think it was stupid that President Obama got himself sucked into this. I think everyone all around was wrong. Professor Gates, Sergeant Crowley, President Obama should have stayed out of it. Here's why I think this. You know, having had my share of scrapes with law enforcement during my growth period, if you will, I understand a cop's point of view. I get it. He was called to the scene. He had no idea what was going on. He was obviously all business. I get that. He encountered a guy who was ticked off. He couldn't get into his house. He was mad. He was all upset. I can understand that. And then he was forced to answer a bunch of questions. Another scenario that I'm pretty familiar with. What we have here is not a racial situation. This is a mine is bigger than yours male situation. This isn't about race. This isn't a race problem. This is a gender problem. And the beer thing was just ridiculous. Just plain ridiculous. You know, I like President Obama. But, you know, why not use that time to start regulating the big banks, fix our insane tax code that allows Warren Buffett to pay half of what his secretary pays in taxes. Start doing that stuff. Stop worrying about this. And at the end, I hope that calmer heads will say this wasn't a racial issue. Now, I am not saying that this kind of stuff often is not racial. I'm saying this incident, from what I have seen, is not a racial issue. This is simply two guys in a room, waving around, saying mine's bigger than yours, and I'm gonna exert my power. That's all it's about. Anyway, we're gonna take a quick break right here. 1-877-960-0960 before we wrap this up. What are your comments? We're right back. Welcome back, 1-877-960-0960. This is the Rick Smith Show. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I don't know if you saw this past week. Former Governor Elliot Spitzer was on MSNBC's morning meeting talking about the Federal Reserve. And here's a place, I think, where we can all come together. Liberals, conservatives, independents, people with tinfoil hats, teabaggers, whatever. I think we can agree on this. Listen to what he said. He said the Federal Reserve is a Ponzi scheme that has created bubble after bubble in our economy and needs to be held accountable for its actions. It's insane to me that we have a secretive, private, for-profit interest controlling our money supply. It's insane to me. And what Spitzer calls the bank bailout, the America's greatest theft and cover-up ever. He's advocating in favor of a House bill to audit the Federal Reserve. He said, quote, the Federal Reserve has benefited for decades from the notion that it is quasi-autonomous. It's supposed to be independent. Let me tell you a little dirty secret, he said. The Fed has done an absolutely disastrous job since former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker left. And what's interesting, he says the reality is the Fed has blown it time and time again. They blew it bubble after bubble. They've failed to understand what they were doing to our economy. The most poignant example for me, he said, is the AIG bailout, where they gave tens of billions of dollars that went right through conduit payments to the investment banks that are now solvent. We, the taxpayers, didn't get stock in those banks. They didn't ask what was going on. This begs and cries for hard, tough examination. And, you know, you go back to when he wrote the op-ed more than a year ago, before they put him under surveillance, finding him with the hooker. And they had to take this guy down because he got it. He understood what was going on before this whole collapse happened. And I'm telling you, this is where I think all of us should be screaming to our elected officials. Investigate this. Audit the Fed. Find out where this money's going. Let's take a quick call. We got Art on line one. How you doing today, Art? Art, are you there?
Yes, I'm sorry. I drive a truck. I'm home wasting time, so I don't get to watch a lot of TV, but I do listen to a lot of radio. And it's usually, I don't know, different part of your brain when you listen, you don't use your visual part. So you listen to what people say more so than on TV.
Okay.
None of this ever has added up in my head. They came out with a figure a while back that all the bad mortgages together was about $100 billion. And they are giving out trillions of dollars to the banks and the stockbrokers. And my study of it, I don't think it's because people got behind on the mortgages that caused this problem, but you had a couple of problems. You had an energy where we're sending so much overseas, depleting our savings. You had a lot of people had used credit cards to buy energy and heat cool their heat their homes during the winter. And you had the billions of dollars going overseas and it was not circulating. And you had the banks speculating in the stock market on margin. And when the stock market fell, the banks got margin calls, and that's why a lot of these banks came up shorthanded. It's not, like I said, it's not because people having trouble paying their mortgage. It's because Clinton signed the law back in '96 that prohibited the banks from playing in the stock market. They passed during the Great Depression. That's what caused a lot of banks to fail. They was playing in the stock market back in the Depression, and they lost a huge amount of money. But they did the very same thing last year and this year. They've lost huge amount of money playing the margins in the stock market.
You're right. And one of my biggest problems with Bill Clinton is the fact that they went and undid Glass-Steagall. He did that in '99, not '96.
I don't have the figures in front of me. I was just going on memory.
Yeah, and you're spot on with the speculation. But I would say that the biggest problem in this country for me is that the workers of this country have not earned sufficient wages over the last 30 years. We've seen productivity skyrocketing. We haven't seen wages keep up. And this mortgage crisis is more about the lack of wages than I think it is about the economic system. Now, that said, the fact that these investment banks were able to bundle these mortgages, these worthless mortgages, and sell them off at a AAA rating really goes to show just how poor the regulatory system was being enforced during the Bush years in particular.
Well, even if all that's correct, which probably is, but if the numbers still don't add up, if you add up all the bad mortgages, it don't come up anywhere near as much as they give out in these bailouts. Understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with you on that, because the mortgage industry is a multi-trillion dollar industry. Here's where the problem is. We don't know what the bad mortgages are. We only see the bad mortgages once they're foreclosed on. There's so much of this paper still out there, and which is why I'm concerned that the Fed is basically saying, here's a blank check, we're going to bail you out. Because what I'm told is there's a liability of almost $13 trillion out there. So when you say it's only a couple hundred million dollars, I would really love to see where you're getting that from, because the information that I'm getting is the liability is in the $13 trillion range.
I hadn't heard that, but it's not like the money disappeared. The homes are still there. They may not be worth quite as much, and I'm just a simple old country boy from Tennessee, and math never has been my brightest subject, but these numbers have ever added up for me. It's hard for me to follow it, but then you got people with PhDs just trying to make it as confusing as possible.
No, I agree with you, man, and I appreciate the call. Thanks so much. Here again, it comes back to speculation. I mean, we've created this environment. Our government has allowed this environment to fester, where we have allowed the speculators to come in, pump up the whatever bubble you want, the tech bubble, the housing bubble, you name it. They've allowed it to pump up and then dump it off. You look at Mark Cuban, for instance, one of the smart guys from the tech bubble. He made a whole bunch of money with nothing companies. He dumped them, and the bubble went pop. And he walked away with big money. It's that kind of stuff, man. And, what I said from the very beginning in this, especially talking to Art, what I said from the very beginning, what we should have done is we should have taken the billions of dollars that we gave to the big banks, and we should have made the people on the bottom whole. The working people, the people whose mortgages were being foreclosed on, the people who lost their pensions. Those are the people that I advocate for. And what's important to understand is that the voices that you get to hear every day on the mainstream media are corporate voices. This isn't a liberal Democrat thing. This isn't a conservative Republican thing. This isn't that kind of paradigm. This is corporatist versus the rest of us. This is huge multinational interests versus the rest of us. And you look at this mortgage thing. What they did is they bundled all of these mortgages up into a bundle. And they sold it off, stamped it with a AAA rating, sold it off to investors as, top of the line, grade A investment. And you saw all around the world, the Saudis in particular, spent a lot of their petrol dollars buying up those commodities. And what happened? The more people bought them, the more the price went up. The more the price went up, the more profit there was, the more virtual wealth was created. And like Art said, the houses are still there. They're just worth about $30,000, $40,000 less than they were a year and a half ago. And why is that? Because we had a Fed that said, we're going to lower interest rates to the point to where we can just give away cheap money. So the more cheap money that people had, the more they wanted to go out and buy. And that caused a spiraling up of the housing prices. But as soon as everyone realized, cheap money doesn't last forever. We got to pay that back. The bottom fell out. And, you go back and you look at the mortgages that were written. Interest-only loans. these adjustable rates that give you 1.2% interest for a year. And then you're at the whim of the market. It's insane. And again, I agree with Art. Bill Clinton should have never allowed the Phil Grahams of the world to push through that legislation. You can't just blame Bill Clinton for this. This was Phil Graham. This was the Republican Congress also, because they believe the same thing. They believe that Wall Street is the answer, And I'm telling you, folks, it's Main Street that's the answer. Wall Street has always been our problem because they are only concerned about the wealthy. They're only concerned about how much coin they can put in their pocket. And where are they getting that coin? They're getting it from you. And you look at this deal with Carlisle Tire and Wheel, exactly the same scenario. They're cutting jobs right here so they can profit somewhere else. And they can get huge, massive subsidies from taxpayers. And you and I are paying that. I mean, it's like putting a big sign on our back saying, kick me and I'll pay you for it. A big thank you. You know, somebody kicks you in the behind, you say thank you. It's basically what's going on. And I'll tell you, it's frustrating. Anyway, I had tons of stuff to get to today. I appreciate the calls. We'll be back right here tomorrow, noon to 2. Again, you know, we got to stay involved in this stuff. We have got to call our politicians. We have got to call our elected officials and say, look, you got to help us. Help the working people for a change. Help my brothers and sisters who go to work every day. Stop bailing out Wall Street. We'll see you tomorrow.
It's coming through a hole in the air. It's coming from the field.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Tune in every Saturday and Sunday from noon till 2 p.m. on WHYL AM 960. Or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Democracy is coming.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Thanks for lending an ear.
Oh, there's no hurry. Tonight you'll be at Rick's. Everybody comes to Rick's.
I have already heard about this cafe and also about Mr. Rick himself.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine. What's that you're playing?
Oh, just a little something of my own.
Oh, stop it. You know what I want to hear.
No, I don't.
You played it for her, you played it for me.
Well, I don't think I can remember.
If she can stand it, I can. Play it.
Too tight. The bees don't want to go to sleep. I'm your man.
Howdy there, and welcome to Rick's Place. We are open and ready. Here's the proprietor of Rick's and Horn's psychotherapist, Rick Goodner.
Hello, Rangers. This is Rick Goodner, and you're you, and you're at Rick's Place here at Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. You're going to occasionally hear a bit of thunder in the background. We're having one of those magnificent things that we never get here in Texas in the summertime, which is a nice thunderstorm with plenty of rain. It's been going on morning, and it has got my blood hot, and I'm loving every minute of it. I love the rain, I love the storms, I love the excitement of the heavens exploding up there. It's beautiful to me. And it's got me in a beautiful mood, at least one that I believe is beautiful. Head On Radio Network has maybe a month left, unless things change pretty darn fast. Kick in your money now, or it's not. Ooh, and the thunder accents what I'm saying. And it's not going to last. It's that simple. And here, at this time, is when you need the oldest liberal voice in America. More than ever. You'll get to the reasons of that very shortly. Some of the things I'm going to talk about today, well, to be honest with you, no one really knows what I'm going to talk about until I start talking. But Bob's been kept out of the loop. Everybody's been kept out of the loop up to now. And now, I want Ben and Bob and John to become part of something much bigger. And I want you to become the moving part of something much bigger. I will get to that. This is a little teaser. But first of all, I would like to say something nice about Mr. Obama. Remember when we were talking months and months ago about how Mr. Obama's not keeping his campaign promises, did not end the war. Doesn't look like he's going to get the health care thing through in any usable decent sense, immigration reform, all those things. Remember all the things he promised and then all the things he went immediately to the right and didn't do? And I said at that time, the only way to get him coming out swinging and get him to come back to his promises was for his poll numbers. I love that lightning right at the proper time. His poll numbers to drop. And you've noticed. They have dropped substantially. And what else have you noticed during this time? He's got back out there again. He's hitting hard on the campaign again. He's talking up the issues again. In other words, he's doing what you made him do. You did it, Rangers. You did it. And it started here on the Horn. Nobody else was saying anything about this except here at the Horn. You started it. You got it moving. And now it's became really big. Mr. Obama's approval numbers are going down in the liberal camp because he has not kept any of the promises he made us when we put him in office. We did put him in office. Not the middle of the roaders, not the Republicans. We did it. But they get paid back for it. Most of the members of his cabinet, Republican leaning. We have seven idiots in the Democratic Party, those Oreocrats, who are holding up everything. Just seven. Just seven. And we're allowing it to happen. We're not going for the juggler. It's ridiculous. Doesn't really matter. What matters is we have decided that the only way to get Mr. Obama moving and doing the right thing was to lower his poll numbers. His poll numbers are lowering, and he's getting out and he's doing his job. Thank you, Mr. Obama. Thank you for doing your job. Thank you for starting to hold to your promises. Thank you for doing what you said you were going to do. Shock upon shocks, a politician doing what he said he was going to do. I told you, Rangers, as long as his poll numbers were up in the 60s, there was no way in the world he was going to take any chances. The only way was for us to back off. We have backed off. His polls are dropping, and he's getting out there and he's doing things. And his polls are going to go back up again. The numbers will go back up. They will. And then he'll stop doing what he's supposed to do again, and they'll go back down a little bit. But this is what we have to do. We have to keep his feet to the fire. It's for his own good. Fire. Maybe that's going to be the theme of this show. Fire. For his own good, we'll make him a man. And then, my dear Rangers, he can stand out there on the front lawn of the White House, and he can sing to the top of his voice, "I'm a man."
Well, my dad's in a minute, all the whiskers on my chin. Never had no problem, cause I always paid the rent. I got no time for loving, cause my time is already done. I spent a time for it, on the food and time to love. Come on.
Mr. Obama is becoming a man. It's about time. Thank you, sir. You are now a man. Oh, there's another Seth here in Washington that needs to stand up on their hind legs and become men, but they're not going to. I know you've heard about them. They're the insurance company lap dogs. You know, the blue lap dogs, Democrats, the ultra-conservative right-wing Democrats. You know, Oreocrats, as I called them for a long time. They're the ones who's putting the kibosh on health care. And they're not doing it out of any ideology. They're not doing it out of any thoughts of conservatism that they really, really believe in, which the damn news is saying, which is a lie. The for-profit news is covering for them. They even call them moderates. What's moderate about a group of dogs who will let you die for their master? Big pharmaceutical and big insurance. No, they're not moderate. They're conservative. You know, conservative mindset, what put us in this mess to begin with. What has proven to be useless and unworkable. Conservatism. Which would end up, if it was allowed, to run to fruition in the death of America. Like it is now, the death of so many uninsured Americans. These blue lap dogs have stopped and has perverted the health care that America deserves. No. I've heard Republicans say many a times, well, health care isn't a right, it's a privilege. Bull! It's a right of every American to have access to decent health care that can keep them alive. And it's not only a privilege for the privileged few to have. Baucus. Mr. Max the Mongrel Baucus. You dog. You curd. You mutt. That's the same as the female group of your pack. Those bitches that support you too. And all the other mongrels out there that support you in your pack of lap dogs. You are destroying the health of Americans. And you are scaring old Americans with your lies and your rhetoric. Mr. Obama mentioned an email that he received. A woman was very upset. I don't want any government health care. I don't want any socialized medicine in America. And keep your hands off my Medicare. What? Come on. What is Medicare but socialized medicine, you morons? Every damn one of these teabaggers who are out there hollering, no socialize this, no socialize that. They are hypocrites because every damn one of them will accept their Medicare. I have a Republican who comes in every once in a while. We have us a nice little short argument before he gets mad and stomps out of my office. Because I always, after he gives this tirade about how we cannot have universal health care, we cannot have socialized medicine, we cannot have government making decisions about medical care, and I remind him that his Medicare is socialized government-controlled medicine. Also remind him that the VA system in America is the best hospital system in America. Provides the best care at the lowest price, and it is a government-ran system. Why are these insurance company lap dogs who say they're members of the Democratic Party, who say they are Democrats but are really Oreocrats, who are there destroying our chance at good health care in America, why are they doing what they are doing other than the fact that they're getting millions and millions of dollars from the insurance companies? They're there to wreck our health and line their pockets. They are the worst of the Judas among us. these Kurds, these mutts, these mongrels, these lapdogs of the corporations who are killing us. We don't need an agreement with them. We do not need any agreement with them whatsoever. We need them to do what they are sent there to do, or they need to be replaced. Why is Mongrel Bacchus still over that committee? Why? Because he's being protected. That's why. Other oilcrats are protecting him. Other oilcrats that could take him off the committee and put a decent person in, they're protecting him. Because, see, they get money, too, from the insurance companies. Not as much, but they get it. They need to be voted out. Every single one of them needs to have a candidate put up against them. They need to be shown for what they are. Crooks who take bribes from insurance companies, and they need to be thrown out of office. I love a good thunderstorm. It gets my blood hot. It makes me feel so good. We've got to do something, and not tomorrow. Now. We've got to start to work now. We have sat back for too long on our thumbs and not done what needs to be done. I will get to what needs to be done. I will get to fire in the streets. I will get to that later. But for now, we must understand that Bacchus and his pack of corporate lapdogs are hurting you. They're going to take a recess. Now, you know, these congressmen work so damn hard out there carrying bricks and mortar and laying down highways and doing all the things that really wears out a man so he dies young. They're doing all this stuff. They're working really, really hard sitting in those leather chairs, taking in their corporate money. So now they need a nice vacation. What the hell are they doing taking a vacation? Okay. It gets hot in August. Da-da-da! In Washington. I live in Texas. You want to see hot in August? Come here. Come here. And don't whine to me about why you need to leave in August to go back home because it's so hard to go from your air-conditioned house to your air-conditioned limousine to ride to your air-conditioned office. It's so hard to do that in August, isn't it, Mongrel Bacchus? There's been a small breakthrough. Not one that I like. Matter of fact, I think it's a betrayal, not a breakthrough. Got that, Harry Reid? Betrayal of the American people. And when did they set this betrayal up? They set it up to happen on the 31st of July. Why? So they can take their August break. So they can go home and it will give a month for the insurance and pharmaceutical companies to lie to the American people about what's good for them, to scare old people into thinking, we don't want socialized medicine, but don't touch my Medicare. In other words, to work on the weak-minded and stupid amongst us, which they have been able to control for so long. We're going to get some health care reform, but it's going to be garbage. We sent a revolutionary... We sent a group of revolutionaries to Washington to clean up the healthcare mess, to stop that stinking war, to help workers get unionized, to help with immigration reform, to get America back. We sent them. We had a revolution at the polls, and we sent them to do our job. And they have not done it. They have not done it. too many conservative Democrats, working with too many Republicans in office. Every damn Republican must be voted out. They must be thrown out on their ears. And they must lose their government health care, which they're not going to let you have a part of. I heard a doctor the other day. He was sitting around with a group of nurses, and he was telling about the evils of this health care reform. The stupid moron, which I didn't call him. But I sat there and listened in silence as he gave his Rush Limbaugh take on what health care was going to do for us. And then I calmly and gently told the truth. You know Rick. Rick can be very calm and very gentle. And I was very, very calm. I told him and all the nurses listening, for one thing, being a small hospital out in the country, the rules have changed under the health care reform if it goes through, so that the hospitals will make more money than they were making before. Those rules would allow for the doctors to make more money, for the nurses to make more money. Therefore, there's more money in their pocket. And Dr. Hubbard, yes, I will give his name, you said that there's a gigantic tax being put on working Americans. That's a lie. I didn't say it that way. That's wrong. Every taxpayer in America, including the richest of the rich, has got a tax cut under Mr. Obama. No one has got a tax hike. No one. And you are a conservative, are you not, doctor? You believe in free enterprise and competition to control prices, right, doctor?
Well, of course.
The only thing the health care reform is going to do is give one more choice, to add one more bit of competition to the insurance companies. Why are you against choice? Why are you against competition as a conservative who believes in the free market? That is what we're up against, guys. That. Oh, by the way, when the good doctor toddled off in a rage, most of the nurses said, I'm for the health care reform. And then they had a few choice words for the fine doctor. This is what we're up against, guys. When I walked in there, he had the nurses enthralled with all the money they were going to make if the health care did not change. Had them enthralled with all the wonderful possibilities and all the evil, evil things that was going to happen with the socialism that was going to creep into America. And in less than 5 minutes, I was able to show the truth and destroy his entire day's work. It's what we all have to do. We have to talk it up. We have to march it up. We have to move. We have to do things. We've got to show these corporate lapdogs that they can lose. They must pay a price. If they're going to sit here and hold our health care as hostage, we must up the ante on them and make them pay a higher price. Let them go out and find a job carrying bricks, mixing mortar. Kidding me, guys? They've got to be kicked out of office. They got to be kicked out of office. They got to be thrown out of office. We have had enough with them killing us. They have committed murder upon us. And they are planning to commit murder upon the American people again. They're not just going to hurt you and me. They're going to hurt your parents, your grandparents, and your children. These monsters are out to kill your children and your parents. If we let it continue, But what are we doing? We're sitting back with our hands folded, twiddling our thumbs, going, wow, we're progressive, really nice. This is really, really progressive. This is really, really cool. We're progressive, yeah, da, 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 da. We're progressive, we're progression. It's time to stop progressing and start liberating. The days of sitting back and expecting the right thing to be done because it's right is over. They will not do the right thing unless they are forced to do the right thing. And now it is time to force the right thing. We have before us 1 month in which the insurance companies are going to lie and spend millions of dollars to do that lie. We have 1 month when the pharmaceutical companies are going to lie and force that lie down the throats of anybody who's stupid enough to watch TV. We have 1 month in which the for-profit media, who wants the insurance company's business, who wants the pharmaceutical company's business, to slant the news into a lie and force feed America the corporate lie as their corporate lapdogs do their work at home, lying to their people about the fine work they're doing in Congress. They are liars and they need to be stopped. We have 1 month of their lies. And we have 1 month to prepare. We have 1 month to prepare. And this is what has to be done. Because on the very first day of September, when they turn back to Washington, and they go back to shiv the knife deeper into your back and twist it, we can sit here and throw our thumbs as we progress towards oblivion, or we can strike. September the 4th, 2009 is strike day. We must enter into Washington on that day and close it down. We've got to clog the streets. We've got to burn the streets, not with fire, not with flame, but with passion. Resolve. We must put our bodies on the road, on the streets, clog the arteries of Washington, D.C. And we must do it for our children and for our parents, who are going to be murdered by insurance companies, by pharmaceutical companies, by the Iraq war, by the war in Afghanistan, by mountaintop removal, by cutting of the forest, by bloody engagements on the border with immigration, by the change of Medicare to hurt our grandparents. We have got to be on the streets. And we have got to strike, and we have got to strike hard. On Friday, the 4th, 2009, do not go to work. Strike for that one day. Do not go to work. Call in sick. Do anything that you want. But call it a strike. No one goes to work on September the 4th, 2009. We will make our bodies stronger, and we will put the block against corporations who are controlling Congress and the presidency. We will make our presence known. We will clog the streets of Washington, September the 4th, 2009. We will stop this in its tracks. We will let them know who we are and what we want. Do not go to work. Do not go to a store. Don't buy a car that day. No. Don't buy a boat that day. Don't buy a house that day. don't buy anything. Strike. Make it a general and complete strike all across America. Stop everything that day. Turn off all electricity. Use no electricity other than running your computer that day. It's going to be warm here in Texas. It will be. But turn off the air conditioners. Turn off the lights. Leave your computer on. Leave your Twitter on. But everything else electric, turn off. Everything that's related to gas, using natural gas or any kind of heat, turn it off. For one day and night, show America who we are and from whence we came. And send shivers down the spine of corporate America. Make our presence known. And you, our friends overseas, stand with us in solidarity. Stand with us and help us to show who we are. On September the 4th, 2009, do not go to Disney World over in Europe. Don't do it. Don't go to McDonald's, because every country, even Indonesia, has a McDonald's. Don't do it. Don't go to any U.S. company. Buy no U.S. cars. Buy nothing America for that one day. Strike. Stand with us. Help your brothers and sisters here. We need you. And then we can stand next to you. And we can all stand together. We've got to set the streets of Washington ablaze with passion, not flames, but passion. We have got to show these Democrats who we put into office why we put them in office. And we got to make it very clear to them that in 2010, those who betrayed us will be gone. We have got to make a difference now. This is it. This is our last chance. There will be no other chance for health care reform in my lifetime. There will be no other chance for me and for you to do what's right to make sure that your kids are not murdered by greedy corporations. There will be no other chance to come together as one in America to stop that Iraq war. There'll be no other chance to order our leaders to follow us and prosecute Bush. There will be no other chance for us to pull it together and strike, strike, strike. Have the moratorium on the war. Have the moratorium on everything. We will show America now what needs to be done. And they will do what they are supposed to do. September the 4th, 2009, strike day. Marches all through Washington. Clog every street. I will be there on Bandana Day. It is Bandana Day. I will wear a white bandana around my neck to show I'm a healthcare worker and I support change. Those of you who wants the war to stop, wear a blue bandana around your neck. Wear it and show who you are. Carry your signs. Make it known the war must stop or the politicians must be stopped. Take your choice, politicians. Do what the American people say or lose it. You're into the environment? Wonderful. So am I. Wear your green bandana that day. March in the streets. Let them know that mountaintop removal is a sin against God, the earth, and your children. You want your children to live. Wear that green proudly. Wear the green bandana around your neck. Labor unions, are you kind of peeved about what's been going on with being able to sign up people for the labor? Start it too. Be there in line. Bring your unions out in force. Wear that red bandana that you wore so proudly before in West Virginia and in Pennsylvania and the other coal fields. Wear that red bandana to show you have solidarity with the others in America and that you stand for the rights of labor. If you feel that immigration is your issue, stand and walk with us. Wear your brown bandana. Because, to be honest with you guys, the only immigration that these racists are concerned about is brown immigration. They don't care about the blonde, blue-eyed whites coming in from Europe. They care about brown people coming in. So wear your brown bandana that day. Show who you are and what you support. Close Washington down. Burn Washington with your passion. Be peaceful. Be passive. But be there. If the cops come after you, passive resistance. Go to the ground and make them arrest you. That's the way a resistance against the government that's gone afoul happens. It started with Trudeau. Trudeau's information got to Gandhi. Gandhi's information and Trudeau's got to Martin Luther King. Gandhi's, Martin Luther King's, and Trudeau's information got to the anti-war marchers during the 60s. And now bring it up to you. Civil disobedience is the only way to make a change, and it needs to be done. It will be too late after September the 4th, 2009. It will be too late. The murderers will be in there setting systems together to kill your parents, to kill your kids, and to kill you. It's time to strike. It's time to set the streets of Washington ablaze with your passion. Burn Washington with your passion, and things will be done. And I want to see, like I saw in the 60s, you had the anti-war protesters there, and there was two little old people getting off a bus at the protest that I was at. A little old man and a little old woman, barely able to walk, who got off the bus, opened up their signs, and walked over to us, locked their arms with us, and walked and marched against the war with us. You people who are going to be hurt, who have been hurt by the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies with the donut hole and everything, be out there. AARP, get the people out there. Wear your gray bandanas with pride. Make the people know who you are. September the 4th, Friday, 2009, strike day, moratorium day, protest day. Close Washington down. Close Washington down. Bandana day. Wear your bandanas. Be there, September the 4th, Friday, 2009. Be there with me. Lock arms with me. Walk with me. Chant with me. And save our country. Those of you that can't make it, strike. 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 No airplane rides. No trains. No buses. Stop it. Strike against them. Don't do it. Don't go out to any restaurants whatsoever. Don't buy anything. And stay the hell away from Walmart. Strike. Don't listen to mainstream news. Strike. Keep your computer on. Stay in touch. Know what's happening. Use Twitter. Stay in touch. Know what's happening. But turn off your electricity in the house. Turn off the gas in your house. use nothing that day that will give a penny to any corporation. Don't drive unless you have to, or unless you're going to a protest march or a protest gathering. Don't do it. Go outside and walk. And the people you meet, say, I'm protesting today. Close every shop. Close every store. Close everything. Ambulance drivers stay on your job. Police, if you're supposed to work that day, stay on that. Those are important things. But stop building the roads. Stop it. Stop. There's no sense. Strike, strike, strike. If you don't strike, we will be struck down. This is our one and only chance. Pull it together. Make it work. You Iraqi veterans, be there. March with us. Help us in every part of the march to keep us uniform, to keep us together. Be with us. Help us. Wear your blue bandana. Let America know that our finest and bravest are with us. Those police officers who are off duty, march with us. This is a time for America to stand, or this is a time for America to fall. We have one of those pivotal moments every generation. This is your moment. Set and progress, or stand with us and liberate. Those are your choices. Strike, strike, strike. Close down Washington. Set the streets ablaze with your passion. Buy nothing that day. Spend not a penny that day. Stand with us, or allow the ones you love to be murdered by corporations. Those are your choices. It's that simple. You can wait for your kids, your grandkids, to be sent to Iraq to die, or you can stop the war. You could wait to take your child or your parent into an emergency room and be patched up and then turned away because you have no insurance and you can watch them die. Or you can get universal health care for everybody. It's your choice. You can continue to watch the mountains be topped and removed and pushed into the valleys and pollute your water and your air. You can continue to watch the forest being cut down, roads being built through pristine wilderness, wolves being hunted from helicopters, or you can stand with us and you can stop the bloodshed. It's that easy. Those who are older among us, who now have access to government socialized health care in the form of Medicare, can watch it be taken away, or you can fight and keep what you have earned. Wear your white bandana if you work in health care and if you're supporting health care. Wear your blue bandana if you want the war to stop. Wear your green bandana if you're for the environment. Wear your red bandana if you're for labor. Wear your brown bandana if you're for decent rules with immigration. Wear your gray proudly around your neck if you're for keeping your dignity as you grow older. If you support them all, braid them together and wear every color as a bandana around your neck. September the 4th, 2009, Friday, strike, strike, strike. Set the streets of Washington ablaze with your passion. Buy nothing. That day, spend not a penny for any corporation that day. Watch no network TV that day. Watch none of the commercials they show that day. Stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it now before they stop you. They're out for your money. They're out to destroy you. Don't be stupid anymore. Strike or be struck down. Our passion must become the fire in the streets.
Ah!
Okay, Rangers, take a little break. We'll be right back here at Head On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice. You're at Rick's Place, and I'm Rick Goodner. Contact me at rickgoodner@gmail.com. I'm also on Facebook. Rick's Place is on Facebook as well. Be back shortly, and then we'll close up.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
You're listening to Rick's Place on the Head On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice. Hang in there, Rangers. We're fixing to be right back.
Hi, boys and girls. This is Rick Goodner, part of the Weekend Wrecking Crew. And I'm here to tell you that you cannot miss Billy Shears. The man knows his music. The man knows what you're thinking. Tune in and listen. You'll be surprised. He's going to play the very song that you were thinking that you needed to hear. He's a genius. Maybe a bit psychic. I promise you. Tune in on the weekend, listen to Billy Shear's Night Sounds, and you will hear the song you've been waiting to hear. And you'll enjoy your time as much as I do. Right here, on the Horn, Head On Radio Network. Make sure you don't miss what you've been waiting to hear with Billy Shear.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Play as time goes by.
Welcome back, Rangers, to Rick's Place. Now, here's the number one Ranger, the proprietor of Rick's and Horn's psychotherapist, Rick Goodner.
Long way to go, the stars tell me.
Hello, Rangers. Welcome back. You're at Head On Radio Network. Rick's Place. It's Rick Goodner. And Head On Radio Network, of course, is the liberal voice, the oldest liberal voice up and running. Let's keep it that way. Click over there on the PayPal. Make your donations. Let's make sure that we can keep this going. I talked a little bit last hour about September the 4th. Let's keep that in mind. We need to do a strike. We need to make ourselves known. The days of the liberals sitting over in the corner and chewing on a bone are over. Now we get what we wanted. All we have to do is make it known that we still want it. But before we get to that, I'm going to touch on something that I promised myself I wouldn't touch on, but it's got just two damn weird not to. Okay. During the news conference, Obama made a little bitty statement about the white policeman and the black house owner. And, of course, the right wing, because they're race baiting, have went after him. They have attacked him as being, you know, catering to the black community, showing his true colors. Not the president of America, he's the president of the black people. You know, trying to scare the xenophobic racists among us. Because that's their base. That's all they have left. And they have to kind of keep them. So there's been a lot of talk about Obama catering to the black community, which they knew they were going to sooner or later. Because he made the statement that racial profiling is still real. Well, look, guys, racial profiling is real. It is real. It happens. Same as financial profiling. I had a pickup that I just loved to pieces. 1969. Used to drive it everywhere. And it was about as beat up as anything you can imagine. And I was stopped constantly. No reason. I usually drive under the speed limit in places. But as long as I was driving that 69 Ford around, kind of beat up, well used out in the prairie, cops would stop me constantly, especially if I was in a larger city. Always be some made up thing like, oh, you just went over the white line. I had one time a cop stop me because I was going too slow. Because he said drunk people go too slow. I may have been going maybe a mile under the speed limit, because that's usually where I try to keep things, because I don't like getting stopped. But anytime I drive my other car, I never get stopped. Ever. Not once. But back when I was driving that old beat-up old pickup, that old Ford, that wonderful workhorse, I got stopped constantly. So there is a financial ism, don't know what the word would be, of profiling. Here's this guy inside of this beat-up old pickup. He must be a druggie, or he must be drunk, or he must be doing something mean, nasty, and horrible. So let's stop it and just take a look at him. Drive around in my other cars, and nope, nothing at all. Even when I'm speeding, I don't usually get stopped. Which I do in the other cars. So there is a form of profiling. I know it's racial. I know it's financial. And it's real. And Obama was speaking to that. But here's where I have to disagree with Mr. Obama. And an awful lot of the black commentators, too. I don't for a moment believe that this was racial profiling. The young woman did what any neighbor would do for another neighbor. Someone was jimmying the door. And if I'm jimmying the door in the middle of the night, I hope the neighbor calls the police. When they come up, I'll explain who I am. If he wants to see my ID to prove that I'm really who I am trying to get into my house, I will show it to him. Because in that situation, I want him to be sure that I'm not a person trying to break into my own house. I don't want him to think that I'm somebody that just busted in and then lied and said I live there. So I would show him the ID. That is an appropriate reason to ask for an ID. Although, legally, I do not have to show it to him. I do not. And I heard stuff like, well, if that was a white man, that wouldn't have happened. He wouldn't have been arrested. I beg to differ, my friends. My black, my brown friends, I beg to differ. If that was a white man who refused to show his ID and got, you know, holding out his constitution saying, I have a right to be here, this is my home. I have a right not to show you my ID, which is in the Constitution, although states are putting up laws saying you must show an ID, which I think is unconstitutional and needs to be brought to the Supreme Court. Oh, God, I keep forgetting. There's tons and tons of Republicans on there now, aren't they? Matters not. Anyway, what we have there is a bit of inferiority complex. As a psychotherapist, I can tell you that an enormous amount of people who become police do it for the authority. They want people to respect and fear them. They want to be able to give orders to people. They want to be able to carry a gun. I don't give a damn, guys. Y'all go with me all you want on this one. But I know it as a fact, without a doubt. If you refuse a police officer their due, what they think you need to do, you're going to get arrested. White, brown, purple, orange, it doesn't matter. Because they feel inferior. It's that small penis thing. They don't feel manly unless you're following their orders. So all my black friends out there who seem to have an idea that this was purely 100% racism, no. That this was purely 100% profiling, no. I really believe that it was purely 100% you follow my orders or else you're going to jail. And you know what? That means everybody in America can be a victim. Now, I don't know if that makes it worse than racism, but it sure puts an awful lot of people in jeopardy of their life and liberty. Not saying that it's okay for one set of people, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, to be put in fear of their life or liberty. But when a cop demands something from you and you don't give it to them, they feel their authority being questioned and they're going to assert their authority and teach you a lesson by taking you to jail. That is exactly what happened. There is no other explanation. Sorry, guys. Sorry. This was not racism. This is small penis. That's what the issue is. And that's all the issue is. I can understand why people who have been victims of racial profiling, and I'm sure an enormous amount of blacks, an enormous amount of Hispanics, an enormous amount of Asians have been a victim of racial profiling. An enormous amount of poor people have been a victim of financial profiling. White, black, purple, again, doesn't matter. But in this case, what I saw, what I heard, was a cop demanded respect that he wasn't getting, so he was going to teach this guy a lesson. And now, he's acting all victimized. The president, who is black, and all the black people in America are out to get me, and all I was doing my duty. Bull crap. Bull crap. You were trying to stretch your penis is what you were trying to do. And what happened was exactly what should have happened. The guy should not have been held for that. Plus, I believe he should sue you. Yes, sue you for false arrest. And the city for false arrest. And the police union for false arrest. Yes, I do believe that. There's enough tape, there's enough people seeing it, that I think the case would probably stand. But we can all come together, we can go sit in the Rose Garden and we drink a beer and make everything wonderful. Well, I can see why Obama needs to do that, because the right wing are jumping all over him because they're racist. They don't hide their racism. They show their racism by calling everybody else a racist. They hate Mr. Obama because he's black. And he has power. And that scares them. It scares them to death. I'm going to play a tape for you now. And in the tape, well, just listen to it.
This president, I think, has exposed himself as a guy over and over and over again who has a deep-seated hatred for white people or the white culture. I don't know what it is. You can't say he doesn't like white people. David Axelrod's white. Rahm Emanuel's his chief of staff are white. I think 70% of the people that we see every day are white. Robert Gibbs is white.
I'm not saying that he doesn't like white people. I'm saying he has a problem. He has a... This guy is, I believe, a racist.
That's our good friend Glenn Beck. You know, Mr. Looney himself. I love that. He starts out on the clip saying, I think this is a guy who hates white people. Well, he's called out on that. No, he's surrounded by white people. I really don't think he dislikes white people. Then Beck turns that around and says, I'm not saying he doesn't like white people. Wait, you just said he hates white people. Now you're saying he doesn't dislike white people. That's crazy, Glenn. And then he goes on to call Mr. Obama a racist. Glenn Beck calling Obama a racist. The white enamel kettle calling the pot white. You got it? He is racist. But see, what Beck is doing and what all the other right-wing idiots are doing, they're catering to their base. White, fearful men. People who are afraid of the black man, especially an angry black man. Because there ain't nothing in the world worse than an angry black man coming after you, right? So you have Rush Limbaugh over there calling Obama a racist. Deep down in my heart, I do not believe that is true. And calling Mr. Obama an angry black man. Those are code words, guys. Those are code words from angry white men to get the fearful angry white men more afraid of the black man who is in power. Their worst nightmare come to fruition. Everybody knows that the Republican Party is the party of racism. We know that. Everybody knows that. We can all pretend it's not true. The for-profit news can pretend that's not true, but it's true. I mean, they even give an audience to Pat Buchanan. I mean, Pat Buchanan is as racist as they come, but yet they let him own and talk all the time. Gee, I wonder who owns the news. Wow. White men. Rich white men. I wonder if they're angry. I don't know. But anyway, here it is. We have these Republican idiots doing everything they can to scare America. And, you know, they're not just going for their base on this one. They're going for the deep-rooted fear of the angry black man that they believe is inside of every single white person. Glenn, Rush, I'm more afraid of that cop than I am of any angry black man I have ever met in my life. Okay? Because every angry black man I have ever met has always been in a bit of control. But when you have a short-penised cop with an inferiority complex, black, brown, orange, it doesn't matter, then you've got a problem because they have to prove that their penis is big. So they got to prove they can tell you what to do and you will do it or you will face the consequences. That man that was taken out of his house was a man of substance, a man of money, a man of position. If he was me, I'd still be sitting in jail now. If I was taken out of my house under the same circumstances, I would be sitting in jail now. Because as soon as they found out that, oh, you can't arrest him for that, you just can't do it, then they would have trumped up other charges. But seeing how this was a high-profile person, I'm not saying a black person, a friend of Mr. Obama's, I'm saying a high-profile person. If he was white, black, it doesn't matter. But if he's a person of substance, of worth, unlike myself, they will drop the charges and he will go home. I, on the other hand, you, on the other hand, you're going to jail. And they're going to trump up some really big charges on you. And you may stay there for a while. Because they're going to teach you a damn good lesson. They're going to put you in your place. And that has nothing to do with race. That has to do with short, skinny penises. Now, I'm sure there's nothing wrong with a short, skinny penis, as long as the guy is not trying to overcompensate with his authority. Until we clean that out of the police force, anytime a police officer comes up to you and starts slamming his manhood around, you might want to step back and realize what kind of monster you're talking to. Give him the space that you would a mad dog. Respect him like you would a mad dog. And kind of walk back. Because these people are there in that position not to protect and to serve, but to fulfill an inadequacy in their life. And that inadequacy has to do with you showing them the respect that they think they deserve. Asked any cop, what is the worst problem that he has in society? No one shows me respect. No one shows me respect? You know, is that the only occupation, the only vocation to where a person believes that he's entitled to complete respect and honor? A lot of people don't respect me. I don't care. Because I'm in good shape, as far as I'm concerned. I don't have inadequacies that I have to compensate for. So, the fact that every single police officer complains about the same thing, no one shows me any respect, shows me that they're in the profession for the wrong reasons. And that would be a good way to clean them out. Just do a little survey 1 year. What's the biggest problem you have with the community? If they write down, they don't show me respect, get rid of them. They're there for the wrong reason. I don't do what I do for respect. I do what I do to help people. If they respect it, good. If they don't, good. It doesn't matter. As long as they get the help they need. There it be, guys. Sorry, my friends. I don't think it was racism. I don't think it was racial profiling. I think it was small penis. That's the issue. Until we can back away from simple answers to our big problems, whenever things come up like this, it's always going to be blown out of shape. Sorry. More so than it needs to be. But you know, Mr. Beck, he has a problem, a real mental problem, guys. He really is quite mentally unstable. And the people who hire him, they know it. But then the people who watch him and listen to him, they're unstable as well. So, blind leading the blind, insane leading the insane. But you know, Mr. Beck's problem is he is afraid of everything. He is the biggest coward I have ever seen in my life. He is so afraid of every single thing that has anything to do with being liberal. It scares him to death. And he's starting to see things. He's paranoid. He's claiming that a very unangry man is angry. And a very unracial man is racist. But you know, he sees monsters everywhere. He also sees vampires everywhere.
All right, let's talk vampires.
The country is full of vampires. The country is full of vampires. We are the only country in the world where
the vampires
come from.
Immigrants, presidents, prime ministers, speakers of the parliament in Australia.
Vampires are going after the blood of our teenage daughters.
We are letting people die on the streets in this country. Illegal immigrants.
Legal, not illegal.
No, legal immigrants.
I don't care. You don't care. I don't care.
Right. We spend an awful long time trying to figure out why the O'Reillys, the Sean Hannitys, those bastards, the Rush Limbaughs, the Glenn Becks are so crazy. Why does a network, why does the radio station, why do they hire these obviously mentally deficient people to give commentary on today's events? Why do they hire such dysfunctionally, morbidly unintelligent and crazy people to do this. I've often been frustrated with thinking about that until I've came to a conclusion. They have to. The news has to have people like that. The radio has to have people like that. Because the people they talk to are hopelessly, dysfunctionally, profoundly stupid and insane. Functionally, I guess, maybe functionally insane, but they can somewhat get along. But they're insane nonetheless. How can they believe that the President of the United States can be a foreigner when everybody in the world, including the Republican Party for sure, if it was true that Mr. Obama, as the birthers believe, is not an American citizen, the Republicans would have thrown that out there so fast so they could have kept him from becoming president. This has went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they have refused to deal with it because it's a non-issue. But the people who listen to these nuts are nuts. The teabaggers are nuts. They have their little tea parties, and all the for-profit news covers it like it's something real and important. It's not. Because when, as a society, we become like these teabaggers, like the people who listen to Rush Limbaugh, like the people who listen to Sean Hannity, that bastard, or the Bill O'Reilly, when, as a nation, we become like that, it's closing time.
There's a voice that sounds like God to me.
Advise that this place be shut up at once.
But everybody's having such a good time.
Yes, much as a good a time. The place is to be closed.
But I've no excuse to close it.
Find one.
Everybody is to leave here immediately. This cafe is closed until further notice. Clear the room at once.
How can you close me up? On what ground?
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much. Everybody out at once.
Okay, Rangers, it's closing time. So we're just going to go ahead and pull everything together. Like I told you, the theme for this show is fire. Fire in the streets, in the form of our passion. Fire in the eyes of the crazy Glenn Beck. Fire in the heart of a policeman who unfortunately feels inadequate and needs respect and love. Fire, fire, fire. September the 4th, 2009. If we pull it together, we can make a difference in this country, something they haven't seen in 40 years. The left back on the street. Back pushing society in a direction it needs to go. And that is away from the right, which has always been wrong. Do your part. Don't just sit back and say, well, we should do something. No, do your part. Go on the blogs. Get started. Talk it up. September the 4th, 2009, shut down Washington. Get things moving. Code Pink, get involved here. The Iraqi war vets, get involved here. Mountaintop removal, get involved. People who see immigration as an issue, get involved. Get involved, get involved, get involved. That's the whole issue. We are sitting back expecting somebody else to do our work, and we cannot do that. We're sitting back saying, okay, well, we give a clear message. Congress knows. Obama knows. They need to do the right thing. Well, it's not going to happen. One thing the wacky right is, including the wacky religious right, all of them, including the teabaggers, is that they unite around their insanity. It's time for us to unite around our sanity. This has gone too far. The corporations are going to screw us on this medical health deal. There are no two ways about it.